Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio. Our focus for the hour this week, part of our week-long multimedia special report on federal acquisition, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer. One of the five areas we're focusing on, all of which you can find at federalnewsradio.com, is suspension and debarment. It's the process by which a contractor can be declared ineligible for new government work because of either actual or alleged misconduct. And it's a hot topic at the moment. There's been interest in the issue by both Congress and the executive branch. Lawmakers are pushing to automatically debar contractors under certain circumstances. And in the White House, the Office of Management and Budget recently issued a memo saying that too many agencies weren't using the suspension and debarment tools that they have at their disposal and telling agencies to review their programs. This hour, we'll hear from two of the agencies that are using suspension and debarment aggressively. The Air Force and the Defense Logistics Agency together processed more than 800 suspensions, debarments, and proposed debarments last year. We'll hear first from Stephen Shaw, the Air Force's Deputy General Counsel for Contractor Responsibility. He's also the Air Force's suspension and debarment official. I asked him to describe his service's suspension and debarment process and what makes for an effective program.
You know, the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, establishes the whole process for this, and it's pretty standard and relatively clear. And the agencies, though, are different in the policy and how they approach that. The Air Force is unique maybe in a few areas. The areas that I think are most important are the kinds of things that I testified about on the Hill last fall, and that is a full-time staff. That's one of the things the GAO talked about. Procedures, and we'll finish up the GAO approach, established procedures and referral processes. And I agree with GAO, those are all important. But I think beyond that, what the Air Force has that's fairly unique is a full-time debarring official. And it's fairly unique because there are only three agencies in the entire federal government that have that, EPA and the Navy being the other two. That enables me to meet with contractors as often as they want to meet with me. I'm totally available. As you notice by coming in here, we have no security in this place. It's very easy for contractors to come in. The other critical piece is independence of the acquisition chain. I think that is absolutely critical. The contracting professionals are way overworked, and it's to be independent of that enables me to look at things. You know, it allow me to do the things that I think are right.
If I understand the process basically correctly, there's two big categories, statutory debarment and, you know, procurement debarment, where you tend to have more discretion, whereas in the statutory debarment area, you have basically none. Have I got that close to right?
Well, yes, but the Air Force doesn't do any statutory debarments up until recent months when Congress is starting to change that, and there's a trend towards that. But traditionally, the statutory debarments are more in the environmental and a few other areas that
Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act type things.
Exactly. We don't deal with those in the Air Force.
So in the areas that you do deal with, you have pretty broad discretion and you have to make a lot of decisions and evaluate and weigh a lot of facts in any given case, right?
Yes.
Is there a way to generalize and describe the process that you go through in the Air Force when a case is referred to you? I know they're all different, and each case has its own.
Well, as I said, the Federal Acquisition Regulation is consistent on how it's done in a broad sense, and then the Air Force maybe tweaks it a little bit. In a broad sense, it's a two-prong analysis that really is involved in suspension or debarment, and that is to determine first whether there's misconduct, certain types of misconduct that have been set out in the FAR. By either a preponderance of the evidence in a debarment situation or by adequate evidence for a suspension. If I determine from the referrals and the various other sources of information that there is the requisite misconduct, and if I determine that it's necessary to protect the government's interest, we send a notice to the contractor. The fact of that notice places them immediately on the excluded parties list system, so they're immediately ineligible for new contracts and task orders. At that point, the contractor then has the opportunity to come in and talk to us, to present written submissions, to meet with us, and they can at that point either contest the underlying misconduct that's alleged in the administrative record, or they can agree that the misconduct happened in effect and establish their present responsibility. So that second prong is the present responsibility prong, and that's really where the discretion comes in.
Right. And in the Air Force process, is putting a vendor on EPLS generally the first step, or do you go out with requests for information and those other kinds of informal things first, usually? I know some agencies do that.
Well, usually is a tough word on that. There are occasions that we will send a show cause letter or request for information. If the administrative record establishes fairly clearly that there is misconduct, then we're more likely than not to go directly to the suspension or the proposed debarment to begin the debarment process on that. If it's not clear, if the evidence is not clear, or if perhaps there's a contract construction issue that's somewhat complicated, we're much more likely to send out a request for information. Mm-hmm. Also, I might add that we have a strong policy in the Air Force to work in a carrot and a stick approach, is what I like to call it. We like to do things wherever possible to encourage contractors to have ethical business practices and to have other internal processes so that they will mitigate the risk of misconduct. So we favor those kinds of contractors. So if there's a contractor that I'm aware of that has a good ethical reputation and I trust them, I'm much more likely to send out a show cause letter than a suspension or a proposed debarment in the first instance, because I trust them to do the investigation and to be honest with me.
And how do those carrots work? Are those built in ahead of time into the contracting process where you require good ethics policies before, you know, even pre-award? Or is it, as you just sort of alluded to, just the fact that you happen to know a company has a good procedure?
Well, it's more the latter than the former of what you said. And it's not just whether I know them, but it's whether they've been responsible in the past. For example, we go out in the field a lot when there's no misconduct being committed by contractors that they're aware of or that we're aware of. It's just to engage in a dialogue with industry. I think that's important, and a lot of contractors also feel it's important. They're big contractors and medium-sized ones that come regularly into this conference room to get our thoughts on corporate governance issues and processes. So that, you know, that is really the key to why discretion is so important here and why some of the legislation that's being proposed to take away that discretion is ill-advised.
Yeah, talk me through some of those concerns that you have, because that does seem to be a hot topic in Congress right now, more automatic suspensions and debarments.
Well, exactly. There's one that's pending, and there's one that's in effect been enacted, and the latter one is the Consolidated Appropriations Act from 2012, and it's unclear whether that'll be in the 2013 bill. But that one, in effect, makes an automatic exclusion. It's not an automatic debarment, but it's termed that certain agencies that are included, including the Defense Department, shall not use 2012 appropriated funds for a contract or a task order if the contractor had been convicted of a felony within the previous 2 years. And then there is a out for that where, following that exclusion, a debarring official can make a determination that debarment is not necessary. So it's a little complicated, but it flips what is currently in place now. What is currently in place now enables the SDO, the debarring official, to make that determination in advance and with that discretion to really be able to help influence the defense industry rather than just being reactive.
Mm-hmm. And you alluded to that a little bit before. It sounds like a lot of what you're currently doing is proactive as opposed to waiting for somebody to make a slip-up and putting them on ELPS.
Well, that's a big part of what we'd like to do. I mean, our numbers of using debarments and suspension are as high as any agency in the country, so we're very aggressive when a contractor is not trying to do the right thing. But we're also very aggressive in working with contractors when they are trying to do the right thing. when they do everything in advance that they can to mitigate the risk of misconduct, and when they address it responsibly and aggressively after management learns of the misconduct.
Yeah, talk to me about those numbers. I'm glad you mentioned them. The last agency-by-agency breakdown was in that GAO, that I've seen, was in that GAO report that you mentioned. I think you guys were second only to Army. Is that just a consequence of having the dedicated full-time staff and, as you mentioned, an aggressive posture toward suspension and debarment?
Well, I'm sorry I did raise the numbers then, because that's really the numbers are not as important, I think, for the Air Force as what we do proactively. I mean, and those are harder to count. So yeah. Numbers are easy to count. So that's what people do look at. But I think being full-time has something to do with that. Also, we'd look at the types of misconduct more broadly than some other agencies do. The Federal Acquisition Regulation says, for example, that if there's an indictment or a conviction, that's sufficient as a matter of law to establish a debarment or a suspension. So debarring officials that are concerned about being sued or are concerned about the quality of their staff or whatever might wait only to do a debarment or suspension when there's a conviction or an indictment. We don't do it that way in the Air Force. We certainly do those cases where appropriate, but we don't wait for an indictment or conviction. We go out aggressively and look at the facts, look at the underlying evidence, and it's been estimated that there's something like 70% of the cases that we do are based upon a review of the evidence where the Justice Department hasn't done anything yet.
You go out looking for cases where suspension or debarment might be appropriate as opposed to having them referred to you from the acquisition community or from Department of Justice?
Yes, I think that's right in part. I mean, we review investigators' reports, interim status reports. We don't wait for final reports. We don't wait for, as I say, indictments and convictions. If we look at things in the newspaper. I mean, not that that's part of the administrative record. It's not. But if we learn of something from media reports, we're more likely to inquire to the field and ask for agents for status reports on the cases.
Getting back to the proactive approach that you were talking about a little bit earlier, agencies have done and even in some cases hosted a couple of fairly big public forums on this lately, and I know you guys have participated in those. There seems to be an effort to do some outreach and education on this. Are there some big misunderstandings about suspension and debarment that you feel need to be corrected?
Well, I think this automatic exclusion business is not really understood yet by contractors, and that's unfortunate because it's in the interest of the contractors as well as the government for responsibility determinations to be made as quickly as possible. And the effect of that was January 1 of this year, and, of course, because of that, a corporate contractor cannot get a new award if they've been convicted within the previous 2 years. So it's in their interest to go immediately to all of their customers to engage in a dialogue about prison responsibility. And we're not seeing that happen, frankly. And there are a couple of big instances in the Air Force where it hasn't happened until the last second before an award because the contractor wasn't really focusing on it. So that's a misunderstanding, and I would encourage contractors in that situation to bring the information to the attention of the debarring official as soon as possible. The other confusing part about that is that unlike the normal debarment where there is a lead agency analysis where a contractor would, for example, come to the Air Force, I would make a decision that debarment was not necessary and that would have government-wide implications. Under the Authorization Act, it does not have government-wide implications. The contractor has to go shopping to every single one of their customers one at a time and make a separate determination because of the wording of that act stating that the agency shall not expend funds.
They have to demonstrate present responsibility to each agency
yes.
that they're doing business with.
Yes, and it's very complicated. It's very difficult for the government as well as for the contractors. So that is unique. That's very different from the normal debarment process where there is a lead agency process. Another misunderstanding is the concept of punishment. A lot of people think that debarment is punishment, and there are some on the Hill that feel that way as well, and that's a part, some would say, of the trend towards automatic debarments. It's not punishment. The real focus is the present responsibility. punishment is great and it's an important goal, but it's an important goal of the criminal justice system. It's not an important goal of the procurement system. So that's a misunderstanding, and it is all the more important that contractors need to engage with debarring officials and talk about processes and ethics programs and remedial measures, as opposed to exclusively whether the misconduct occurred or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the final one that I would comment on is there are some who would think that if there is a problem or if there is misconduct that's discovered by management, that maybe they should fly under the radar and see if they can get away with not having the debarring officials notice this. And that, in my view, is a mistake. More and more coordination is going on among agencies now, and it's very unlikely that misconduct is not going to be discovered. There's a new process that the Justice Department just agreed to engage in at my request initially, and that is to give to the ISDC, the Interagency Suspension Debarment Committee, a list quarterly of all indictments and all convictions anywhere in the country, all deferred prosecution agreements. That entire list is going to go to the ISDC, who will put it on a government website. The beauty of that, I think, is that it enables debarring officials to be aware of misconduct, even if that misconduct had nothing to do with a government contract. So it would pick up things like Foreign Corrupt Practices Act convictions, export convictions, or deferred prosecution agreements. So there's going to be a much broader view by government, generally as a trend, but more specifically because of the Justice Department's agreement to provide this information.
That's Stephen Shaw, the Air Force's Deputy General Counsel for Contractor Responsibility. We'll continue our interview in just a moment when we return with On DoD here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This week's show is part of a Federal News Radio special week-long series on federal acquisition. We call it Inside the World's Biggest Buyer. One of our focus areas is the government's suspension and debarment process, excluding companies from getting new federal contracts or task orders because of alleged or real misconduct. In this half of the show, we're hearing from Stephen Shaw, the Air Force's Deputy General Counsel for Contractor Responsibility. When we left off, we were talking about his office's effort to proactively identify irresponsible contractors rather than waiting for complaints to surface within the Air Force.
We'll go back to something you said a moment ago, which is people thinking that they can fly under the radar. Doesn't automatic debarment create an incentive to try to fly under the radar? Because if you know there's no way to negotiate, if you know there's no way to come to an administrative agreement or any kind of other way out, that it's automatic debarment if the facts become known, you have a pretty substantial built-in incentive to try to conceal those facts as a vendor, don't you?
Well, the problem is, at least in the Defense Department, there's a regulation that was imposed that requires a check the box on solicitations as to whether you've been convicted or not. So I would not anticipate that contractors are going to fly under that radar by having to submit a false statement that they weren't convicted. But the general concept of automatic exclusions is contrary to the good, the good leverage that debarring officials can use by the discretion that they have. So the more and more we work towards these automatic exclusions, the more difficult it is to fight fraud.
And how often do you end up resolving cases through those sorts of administrative agreements versus going to debarment?
Well, we do approximately, we have about 20 administrative agreements, I guess, at any point in time, and do maybe 3 or 4 a year. So when you compare those against the numbers of cases that we brought, I think 350 in the first half of this year, it's very small. But on the other hand, there are lots of cases that we don't bring at all or that we terminate because a contractor has been able to demonstrate that they're presently responsible. So administrative agreements are really sort of a halfway step. It's where the contractor has not quite demonstrated their present responsibility, but has almost demonstrated it, and then we enter into an agreement that's really more like a probation contract, and we'll have certain terms, and then we'll work with them to improve So, we'll take them off the debarment list during that period, certainly. But there are many other cases, as I say, where they've demonstrated present responsibility outright, and they don't need the crutch of an administrative agreement. In those cases, we just terminate.
But like probation, if they violate the administrative agreement, it's additional grounds for debarment, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know you said that this is not a means of punishment, and I've heard many people say that, but I imagine it feels that way if you're a vendor and you can't get any new contracts or orders from the government, at least for a certain period of time, which leads me to ask, I'm sure you've heard this argument before about due process, and particularly with notices of proposed debarment. You know, the argument that I've heard at some of these public fora is that it's a huge due process problem because the contractor potentially could have the first notice that there's any kind of particular problem by getting this notice in his mailbox. He has no opportunity to respond, and he's already on EPLS, and he can't do any more business. Is that a due process problem?
Well, the courts have said that it's not, if it's done correctly, if it's done in accordance with the Federal Acquisition Regulation. I mean, that concern, though, is a concern that we share, and because of that, we are extremely aggressive in getting to the bottom of these issues very quickly. So the timing on these is really driven by the contractor. There are several cases I can think of right now where we've taken a contractor off the list within 2 days because they've come to us with a good story about we want to engage in a dialogue. We've made these remedial measures, and let's take us off the list while we engage in this dialogue. So we look at this very quickly. We don't have artificial time periods where we're not going to look at it. We if there's a opposition to an action that we've taken, regardless of whether there's a lawyer involved or not, we will look at it very quickly. And the FAR itself requires that we act within 30 business days of the final submission by a contractor, and we in the Air Force have taken that to 30 calendar days, and that's a very strict policy that I have, and it is most often done well prior to that even.
Meaning you make a decision within 30 days after they've done their submission as to whether debarment's appropriate, yeah, or some other mechanism is appropriate.
Exactly. And there are many debarments and suspensions that go on beyond 30 days, but that's entirely contractor-driven. It's where they will give us a submission and ask us for more time for another submission, or we give their writing to the field to get the field's view on it, and then we give what we get from the field to the other side, just like a judge would do. I mean, that's exactly what my position is. It's exactly like an administrative law judge. I will listen to information from a contractor, and I'll listen to information from the government, the investigators, or whatever. And once it's ripe for a decision, we make that decision within 30 days.
And what about during the suspension phase, which is, I think, when you're investigating a matter? And I think you have 18 months during which you can leave something in suspension. Do you generally process those much sooner than the 18 months? Do you try, or do they go right up to the wall there?
Yeah, well, the suspensions are the most difficult area. And the theory on a suspension is, unlike a debarment, which is a finite period of debarment, generally not to exceed 3 years, a suspension... There are two types of suspensions. One is if there's a suspension based upon an indictment. If that's the case, then there is no 18-month limit. There's no limit at all. It goes until the end of the criminal proceeding, including all the appeals. It doesn't have to, but it can. And we look at those, and if I determine that it's not necessary to protect the government's interest, we terminate it, even if the criminal case isn't over. If there is no indictment, if it's a fact-based suspension, then 12 months is the limit, unless there's a request from the Assistant Attorney General to extend it to 18 months. And again, those we also look at. But it's particularly difficult in a suspension area because the whole theory of a suspension is that you don't really know the facts yet. The contractor can't be totally candid with me because they're worried about Fifth Amendment considerations. The government can't be totally candid with me about the facts because of the grand jury secrecy of Rule 6E. So you can't really get at what happened here. Like in a debarment, the beauty of a debarment is you can really get to what the facts are very quickly and determine what remedial measures are needed. Suspensions, more often you can't get to the facts, so you can't really even get to the point of present responsibility.
You mentioned pending and recently enacted legislation. And any other notable changes on the suspension and debarment front in the past, you know, few months, few years that have changed the landscape for the Air Force or for the government?
Well, I really think that the Hill's interest has been critical in a lot of favorable good ways and in a few misguided ways, the misguided ones being the folks that are thinking in terms of automatic exclusions. But there are many positive ways. It's focused the attention of a lot of particularly civilian agencies that have never had a program before, and that's to the good. And my personal view, and some of those on the Hill agree with me, the importance of being independent from the acquisition community is something that is getting some traction, and I think appropriately so. There's been a real focus on databases, FAPIS, and other things that give information to debarring officials, and that's always good.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the attention that's been put on this whole area in recent years has generally been positive.
Mm-hmm. You alluded briefly to the Interagency Suspension and Debarment Committee. What's the Air Force's role on that? Has that been of value to the Air Force, or have you been able to provide value to other agencies through that committee?
Well, I think all of the above. It's a sharing generally. Since 1986, I think it started. It's been a sharing of best practices and ideas and shared concerns, and it's been very valuable. We've been active in that from the beginning, as has the rest of the Defense Department. So to the extent that we can bring some of our thoughts to other agencies, that's good. We certainly learn things by listening to what other agencies say. One of the new features relatively new now, maybe 3 years ago, Congress started requiring annual reports from the committee that summarized what all the agencies were doing. And transparency is always good, and that's helpful to us as well.
That's Stephen Shaw, the Air Force's Deputy General Counsel for Contractor Responsibility, here on DOD on Federal News Radio. We'll continue our hour on suspension and debarment in just a moment when we hear from a top official of the Defense Logistics Agency's Suspension and Debarment Program. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Welcome back to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. We continue our hour on suspension and debarment in the government and in the Defense Department, part of our station's week-long special report on acquisition inside the world's biggest buyer. We hear next from the Defense Logistics Agency, which, based on last year's numbers, took 436 suspension and debarment actions. Normand Lussier is DLA's Associate General Counsel for Contracting Integrity. He told me most of their cases are the result of information provided by their customers, the military services.
We rely on the professionalism of our acquisition and contracting personnel, and we have a decentralized process. So we have field activities that handle what we call supply chains. So let's say at Richmond, that's the aviation supply chain. So they buy aviation spare parts, and if they have encounter a contractor who's delivering the wrong item, and he does this over several contracts, they'll talk it over with the local fraud attorney. We have 14 fraud attorneys distributed throughout the United States at different field activities for DLA. So the contracting officer and the fraud attorney talk it over and make an assessment of the contractor, whether there's an adequate explanation for the wrong item. If they feel there's no good explanation, the contractor's not careful, or is intentionally delivering the wrong item so that they can be paid, they'll put together a report and recommendation that essentially concludes they don't want to do business with that contractor for a period of time, almost a cooling off period. This report would be sent to the leadership at that field activity, to the commander. Typically a one-star general officer, general or flag officer. And then that commander endorses the contracting officer's recommendation, and then it comes up to DLA, to the headquarters, to the suspension and debarment official. He, in turn, relies on me and my staff to make an assessment of the recommendation and to prepare the appropriate correspondence for him and to discuss the case with him. That's our process.
And talk me through that process a little bit, if you can, as to how you strike that balance between making sure that you protect the government and, you know, not acting too hastily by suspending or debarring a potentially innocent contractor, putting them on EPLS and all the attending negative consequences that I think is fair to say go well beyond government procurement at this point.
Well, the initial burden is on the field activity to persuade us that there's been misconduct or a history of poor performance, which is more typical. We don't make judgments on whether or not there's fraud or criminal behavior. That's not our job. Our job is whether we got the right item. And if we get the wrong item repetitively over a series of contracts, that meets what we call the standard of a history of poor performance, and that's what we look at. So that, in turn, leads to correspondence to the company, and we indicate what we have. We send them a memo, and we prepare an administrative record, which we provide to the contractor, and it explains why we do not want to do business anymore. We give them 30 days to answer, and if they come in and ask for more time, we give them more time. We ask for an explanation for the history that we have with them. Kind of like you as a consumer, you know, when you go to a store and you have a bad experience, you have a number of choices, Jared. You can continue to patronize that store. You can elect not to go there ever again, or you can complain to the store. Same process with us, only we're required to give an explanation as to why we don't want to do business with them anymore.
It sounds like in DLA's case, vendors pretty much in every case have an opportunity to tell their side of the story before they wind up on EPLS, because I don't think that's the case in every agency.
They don't always get an opportunity to explain their side first. They get to make explanations to the contracting officer early. If those explanations are unavailing, then a recommendation is made up here, and then they get a letter which makes them ineligible and gives them an opportunity to explain why they should not be ineligible.
Yeah, I guess what I was getting to with that question is one of the complaints I've heard, especially with regard to notices of proposed debarment, is that in some cases, that's the first time a vendor has any inclination that there's a problem. And it doesn't sound like at least that's happening in the DLA case. Vendors,
well, I think a company or someone who says that it's the first they've heard of the problem is being somewhat disingenuous. The reason we would issue a notice of proposed debarment is because we had a history of poor performance. And most companies know when they've delivered the wrong item over a series of contracts because there's been communication with the contracting officer who said, why did we get the wrong item? And, you know, there's been a dialogue already. So for them to say they had no clue, not always correct.
Gotcha. Is there any way to characterize the sorts of things that get vendors debarred or suspended in the DLA environment? You've said a couple times delivering the wrong item. Is that the majority of your cases?
Yes.
Repeatedly delivering the wrong item?
In DLA, and the reason is you have to look at our mission responsibilities. DLA is responsible for buying all spare parts and depot-level repairables for the Defense Department, as well as all fuel. Mm. Think of it, Jared, all spare parts. So that means that we're doing in excess of 10,000 contracts a day. A lot are automated contracts where we go out for small quantities. And so what happens is in terms of performance over a series of contracts, we're doing a lot more business than the Army, Navy, and Air Force in terms of number of transactions.
That's Norman Lussier, the Defense Logistics Agency's Associate General Counsel for Contracting Integrity. One more segment with him after a short break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio. I'm Jared Serviv. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio. I'm Jared Serbu. We continue our focus this week on suspension and debarment. In this final segment, we talk with Norman Lucier, the Defense Logistics Agency's Associate General Counsel for Contracting Integrity, about the process of sharing information and ideas about suspension and debarment, both inside and outside of DoD.
We like to meet with our counterparts in the federal agencies and the military departments to talk over common issues and approaches, which is the Interagency Suspension and Debarment Committee. That's very useful for that. Plus, when Congress is looking for information from all the agencies, that ISDC provides essentially a clearinghouse for us. We can provide our input to them, and they consolidate and then make a report to Congress for us. Also, OMB uses the ISDC and will attend these meetings, and so they can talk over, you know, what the administration's position is on suspension and debarment and provide guidance to us directly.
And how about standardization of, you know, training and policies and procedures across the government? Any move in that direction out of the ISDC? Because I think especially for the vendor community, that would be useful if there were sort of a common face to industry, the way we treat suspension and debarment.
Well, there's a common face within DOD. Part of that is because within the Defense Department, we do a lot of procurement. We buy. So our process, our procedures, we coordinate. We know how we deal with each other. We inform each other of the actions that we take. We ascertain who should take what's called lead agency among ourselves on actions. And within the rest of the federal government, the enforcement agencies don't really use suspension and debarment because they're engaged in the enforcement of laws and punishment. So Department of Justice, the Internal Revenue Service, the SEC, they don't really do suspension and debarment. Pretty rare. They have other tools at their disposal, considered law enforcement. Then the rest of the federal government, while they do some procurement, they're mostly in the grant business. You know, they dispense funds to support socioeconomic policies endorsed by the government, like agriculture, transportation, education. They have very large grant programs. So their suspension and debarment programs are structured differently and have a different focus than we do when we're buying things.
Right.
The effect's the same. I mean, they can't do business. A grant recipient who's debarred cannot do business with the federal government. You know, they can't sell to us. In addition, they can't receive money.
We talked a little bit about legislative proposals and recently enacted legislation. Any other changes or trends that you can talk about in suspension and debarment from DLA's perspective, thinking back to, for example, the OMB memo from last November or just any other changes over the past months, years, pick a time frame?
No, we have a very mature program that's worked well for us within DLA. We've had a couple of audits from the DOD IG and several from GAO over the years. And don't want to brag particularly, but they like our program.
You could brag.
Well, they like our program because contracting officers identify contractors they think are creating problems within the supply chain. The leadership endorses a recommendation that we no longer do business. And then it comes up here, and we engage with the contractor regarding why we don't want to do business anymore. And as a fairness principle and as a way to work an issue, GAO and the IG liked it. It's worked well for us that way. There's a lot of coordination within the agency.
From your perspective, are there common misunderstandings among contractors about either the process of suspension and debarment or what they need to do to demonstrate present responsibility to be responsible vendors?
There's one common misperception that we see frequently is contractors think that DLAs, or military departments for that matter, are engaging in punishment. They view the correspondence as punishment. And from our perspective, punishment is the responsibility of the Department of Justice. We're simply trying to protect our business interests, protect the supply chain. And the other is, if they want to continue doing business with the United States, they need to respond to the correspondence and explain what happened. Why did they deliver the wrong item? And we listen to the explanations. Sometimes it's because they have one or more employees who, you know, despite the company's policies, didn't follow those policies and delivered us the wrong item. We listen to that. You know, if that's true, if the company was betrayed by some of its employees, we listen. We restore their eligibility as long as they're not continuing to use the same employees to deliver us product.
That's Norman Lussier, the Defense Logistics Agency's Associate General Counsel for Contracting Integrity, talking with me about suspension and debarment, part of our coverage in a week-long series of special reports on Federal News Radio, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer. That's it for this week's edition of On DoD. To hear this interview again, or to find any of the rest of our coverage from our series of special reports on acquisition, visit us at federalnewsradio.com, search term Biggest Buyer. I'm Jared Serve. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.